start, right? You started this, sort of. And welcome to the informational meeting on SUPs. And this is Brian Haluska, who's our neighborhood planner, and he's going to start off with a little information on SUPs and then maybe field some questions. I'm going to just take factual notes. That will then go out to anyone who's not here. And then Bill Emery is recording. And then Bill Langford, you might have met him when he was spreading the word. So he helped do this too.
All right.
As Cindy said, my name is Brian Haluska. I've been working with the city for almost 8 years. It'll be 8 years in November on Election Day, day after Election Day. And I've been, for most of that time, I've been the planner for Woolen Mills. I did hand it off to another planner for briefly at one point, and I've got it back now. Cindy asked me to come and talk about special use permits and we're sticking to kind of the facts of what a special use permit is, and some of the regulations that go along with that. And so I'll try to talk about kind of what it is and what the process is for the consideration of a special use permit in the city of Charlottesville. And I'm not very well versed on the application that everyone has at the top of their mind, mostly because last night was a planning commission meeting and I was working on a rezoning over in Belmont up until that point. And so I've been in the weeds with that application, and I haven't really evaluated this one. Staff's opinion and our opinions and our findings and our recommendations on these are published at when the staff report is released. And that staff report will be released September 4th. It's a week prior to the Planning Commission meeting. We put it online. It's on a PDF on our website. And so my recommendation will be in that staff report, along with my consideration of the standard of review. But we'll go through that. Special use permits. There are two types of actions that pretty much everything the government does, there's two buckets that they fall into. One are actions called ministerial actions. And ministerial actions are actions that the government can't get around. We've got to do them. And, you know, if a sewer line breaks, we've got to fix it. We don't have a choice. Those are ministerial actions. A lot of times when we're dealing with applications for development, a lot of them are ministerial in nature. What we have, if you've ever experienced a site plan, which Timberlake Place went through after they were rezoned, they had a site plan, they submitted it to us, if they meet the regulations in our code, they got approved. That was the end of the story. Didn't matter if people didn't like it, it was going to get built, as long as they met the regulations. Same thing if you've ever had to do a subdivision of your property, change the lot lines of any, if anyone here's changed the lot lines of the property, or if you've bought a house and gotten that plat from the circuit court, somebody parceled out that little piece of land at some point from a larger piece of land, the same thing happens there. When people submit a plat to us to move a lot line, we look at the regulations, they meet the regulations, they get approved. There's no discretion involved in it. That other bucket that I was talking about, or my two buckets, are discretionary actions. Discretionary actions, the government can do it, but they don't have to. So if a sidewalk breaks, we've got to fix it. That's a ministerial action. But the choice to build a new sidewalk, that's discretionary. That depends on funding. That depends on the availability of maintenance funding, things like that. And the reason I bring up this distinction is because special use permits and rezoning, we had a Timberlake Place, or the original PUD application was a rezoning. These are discretionary applications, discretionary actions that the government undertakes. People request it. The government doesn't necessarily have to grant it. And so that's what a special use permit kind of falls under. So in the city, we've zoned every piece of property. For those of you that aren't aware what zoning is, I'm sure pretty much everyone knows this, but for those that don't, zoning is a method by which we regulate land use within a city, within any kind of locality. Pretty much every locality in the city has some form of zoning, or any in the state will have some form of zoning. Every piece of land in the city, just about every piece of land in the city, is zoned. We have some sort of zoning classification. This entire neighborhood, just about from where we are, is the piece of land we're standing on, is zoned R1S. That's a single-family residential zoning, actually. But obviously, this church has been here long before we ever had zoning. It can still be here as long as it wants. All these houses along the side of the road, all zoned the same. Same zoning. Zoning lists out the number of the kinds of uses that you can do in that zone. So in our zoning ordinance, if you go in there, you look up the various classifications that we have, and we have about 30. Each one of those has, there's a big table in each of the sections, and it lists out all the uses that we permit in the city and whether you can do them in that zone or not. And so when we're going through that list and coming out with a, yeah, there it is. Bill's got it. It's fun reading, trust me. So when you, if you go to that table and you will pull out, you look, pull it out and you look at the zoning classification, and you go down, there'll be a big, there'll be a box where it intersects with the zone. There'll be a letter in there, or there won't be a letter. If there's no letter, it means you can't do it, period. You can't do it. You cannot do an office building in a single family residential zone. Can't do it. Not allowed. You can't do a school, but you need large setbacks. Things like that. So if it's not allowed, you just can't do it at all. Sometimes you'll see a B. In many cases, you'll see a B in there. B means by right. By right uses are allowed without any special approval whatsoever. If you want to build, if you've got a piece of land that's zoned R1S, single family residential, and you say, I want to build a house, there's no special approvals involved. You just submit a building permit and you go. You do it. As long as you can get it in the setbacks. You do have to get it in the setbacks. So with our commercial zones downtown, we allow a lot of uses. Offices are allowed down there. Multifamily residential, this is on the mall. Stores, obviously, all permitted by right. You can do them as just a matter of right. There are some uses in each zone where they could be appropriate, but they might not be. And for those, we have what we call a special use permit. What a special use permit allows the city to do is when someone wants to do one of these uses that may be appropriate in this zone, we have a further level of review. They have to ask for special permission to get them. And these are, generally speaking, the standard of review is, if we wouldn't allow them if they weren't, we wouldn't allow them by special use permit if we were never going to grant them. So there's something about these uses that can make them appropriate in these zones. But we want to be able to manage the impacts of them. There's some sort of impact that these uses have on these zones that we want to be able to take a look at and make sure that those can be taken care of before we approve that use. So that's kind of what a special use permit is. And I've got my standard review over here, that's why I keep going to it. So let me talk a little bit about a process. Somebody comes in, they have a piece of land or they have a building, in the case that we're talking about, and they want to do a use. They say, I want to do this. And we look in this, we look in the ordinance and we say, oh, by special use permit. You've got to do that. You've got to do a special use permit. What they will do is they will fill out an application for a special use permit. They will submit it to our office. That comes to the staff. We review it. We may ask for additional information. And ultimately, we will evaluate it and write a staff report. Our staff reports are usually 5 to 6 pages. And we go over a standard of review. There's a standard of review in the code. We're not just looking at this and kind of saying, eh, I don't feel like granting it today. I'm going to recommend denial. Or, you know, I'd really like this use here. I'm going to recommend approval. We have a very set list of things that we have to consider and weigh that application based on. And so I'll go over that. This is really fun reading. This is from the code, section 34-157, general standards of issuance, and this is in the special use permit section. So in considering an application for a special use permit, the city council shall consider the following factors. 1, whether the proposed use or development will be harmonious with existing patterns of use and development within the neighborhood. 2, whether the proposed use or development and associated public facilities will substantially conform to the city's comprehensive plan. We have a very large comprehensive plan that we reference with all of these things. I'll get into that. We're updating it right now. 3, whether the proposed use or development of any buildings or structures will comply with all applicable building code regulations. That's pretty much a given. Can't violate those. 4, this is the one that we reference more than any other. Whether the proposed use or development will have any potentially adverse impacts on the surrounding neighborhood, or the community in general, and if so, whether there are any reasonable conditions of approval that would satisfactorily mitigate such impacts. potentially adverse impacts to be considered included, but are not necessarily limited to, the following. A, traffic or parking congestion. B, noise, lights, dust, odor, fumes, vibration, or other factors which adversely affect the natural environment. C, displacement of existing residents or businesses. D, discouragement of economic development activities that may provide desirable employment or enlarge the tax base. E, undue density of population or intensity of use in relation to the community facilities existing or available. F, reduction in any availability of affordable housing in the neighborhood. G, impact on school population and facilities. H, destruction or encroachment upon conservation or historic districts. I, conformity with federal, state, and local laws as demonstrated and certified by the applicant. And J, massing and scale of project. Now, massing and scale would be if you were building a new building. So there's a few other ones. I won't get into them because we're getting really late here.
Could you reread some of those? You went by kind of fast.
Which ones?
Like the first one, the first set is like fumes or odor.
Any factors which adversely affect the natural environment.
Okay, but we have a printed sheet.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah, this is, if you don't know, our city code is available on a site called municode.com, municode.com. Bill has a printout. They're a company that publishes municipal codes of ordinances, and they keep an online library, and it's free to browse. So if you want a printed copy, that's who you order it from. But it's free to browse, and I go there all the time to look up sections. In fact, that's what the site I'm on right now, so before I got here. And so what you'll see when you read that staff report is you'll see that list, including that 10-point list, that 11-point list I just went through. And we'll discuss every item. What will the impact be? The impact on school facilities for a new daycare and a house, not really a big deal. A big residential development, that's going to have an impact on something like that.
Okay, so like B has all these adverse things, but sound, noise and sound isn't one of them?
I would consider that this is the same thing to me.
Okay.
Noise would be sound.
Just
checking. Yeah.
So.
So this staff report will be presented at a public hearing. If you watched the Planning Commission last night, that's what it looks like. It's at the Planning Commission's regular meeting, second Tuesday of every month. Next one's September 11th. The Planning Commission is sitting at the front of the room. Staff member will deliver the staff report. The City Council is also in attendance for these joint public hearings. So staff presents the staff report. The applicant has an opportunity to present to the Planning Commission and City Council, as well as answer any questions. And then we open a public hearing. A public hearing, anyone in attendance who wants to speak on the item has 3 minutes to address the Planning Commission and City Council. Once everyone that wants to talk has spoken, we close the public hearing. The Planning Commission will debate the item at that meeting, and they can recommend approval, recommend denial, or defer. And sometimes they'll ask the applicant if they want to defer as well. That's what happened to my item last night. Very important note here, the Planning Commission's action is a recommendation only. They are not, when they recommend to approve, the application is not approved. When they recommend denial, it's not denied. It automatically goes to the City Council. City Council is the only body that can approve a special use permit. And so, at a subsequent meeting, they will take the item up, and they will make the final decision. It's one meeting. This is the difference between rezonings. If you've been with a rezoning, it's two readings of a rezoning. It's only one meeting for a special use permit. But they will take it up usually at the first Monday of the following month, which would be the first Monday in October, would be when the item that is in the Woolen Bills is going. So that's the process. City Council does that. We'll make the final decision. They pass a resolution, either approving or denying it, and that's it. It's done. One of the things about special use permits that's a little strange that you don't see with other applications is we can attach conditions to a special use permit. So if we were granting, I've done several for daycares in single-family residential areas. We do allow a daycare if somebody wants to have more than six children, between six and 12 children. Once you're 12, you got to go to a commercial area. In those cases, we'll say that, you know, we will limit the number of other employees you can have on the site. We can limit the hours of operation. Anything that we deem necessary to address impacts that I just read, that list I just read off, we can do that. The closest past application that I've had that deals with a music hall, I did do one music hall, but it was in the downtown area, and I don't think there are any conditions on it. In fact, it doesn't apply anymore because they're now by right down there. But when Club 216 was going for a private club, when they relocated, we had a application. We had a conditions there for security if they were open past a certain hour. We did put a noise section in there. They were still covered by the noise ordinance, but we just reiterated it in the condition. And I believe there was a third one that we were going to limit the hours of operation, and the Planning Commission and City Council pulled it out. They had enough public support to not limit them in terms of their hours. But those are some of the examples that we can do. One of the questions that's come up related to the application with the Lennon Building is whether it covers the whole building. And the application as presented does cover the whole building. It would be allow a music hall throughout the entire building. One of the things that we would do as a condition is limit that size in terms of square footage and the location of it within the building to limit it to the existing unit so it couldn't spread through the entire building. So I don't think it would get approved as just a blanket special use permit for the entire structure. That's basically how they work. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Like I said, my knowledge about the one in the Lennon Building is I've given it out to you already, so.
Does the special use permit belong to the property, the operator of the property, the landlord of the property, or, you know, how does it carry into the future?
It carries with the property itself. So if the proprietor of the business sells the business, special use permit is still valid. If the entire building is sold, special use permit stays valid. The only way to vacate the special use permit is for the owner of the property to actually come in and say, I want to vacate this special use permit. I'm not going to use it anymore, and actually give us something in writing to do that. If they don't implement it beyond a certain time, I think they have 12 months once we pass it. If they don't actually implement that special use permit, then we can revoke it if they're not using it. I caution people to hang their hats on that one too much just because that one is more, there's a lot of special use permits that are out there for additional height or additional density in a project that's, you know, large, like multifamily building. And in those situations, if they haven't pulled a building permit, we've got a very clear way we can define that they haven't implemented it. It's very hard in a situation like we're facing with, you know, an additional use in an already existing building because they can operate it but just not be open. You know, there's a lot of ways that they can get around that. So don't hang your hat too much on that. If they ask to have it revoked, they can have it revoked. There's also, we have a standard in the music hall definition where if a certain number of calls for service from the police are received by the city, that the city council can revoke your special use permit for that. So that's already written into the code, and we can do it in that situation. So sometimes these things are tough to get rid of once they're there, but so that's why we try to constrain them with conditions.
Can I request that people say their names when they ask you a question?
Sure.
John Frazee is my name. And you mentioned that there's public comment before the Planning Commission. Mm-hmm. Is there also public comment once it goes to the City Council, in front of the City Council, or is it really just
our
Planning Commission?
Our public hearings, it's at the Planning Commission meeting. Our public hearings are what we call joint public hearings. So the Planning Commission it's their meeting. They're gaveling it in and running it. City Council is in attendance, and typically there is a quorum present of City Council. If they don't get a quorum present, then they've got to hold their own public hearing. But almost always there's at least three councilors there. They have a quorum, and it serves as the public hearing for both bodies. So in Virginia, you have the option of doing that. Some localities do it, some don't.
But if City Council meets afterwards, there's time for people.
They're technically speaking, I will quote the rules of City Council. They sometimes go away from their own rules. But if you read their agendas strictly, once they have closed the public hearing on an item, they are not supposed to accept any additional public comment in the chamber once that gavel falls at the Planning Commission meeting. It says on the agenda for City Council, at the matters from the public, that they will hear from the public on any matter on which a public hearing has not been held or hasn't been previously held. Now, oftentimes people will come up and address those items, and they're not stopped. The mayor won't stop them from talking about it. You're also free to send emails, letters. There's no rules against that. But if they're going strictly by their rules, they're not supposed to accept public comment at that city council meeting. They're supposed to have heard what they heard at the Planning Commission meeting, and that's it.
Can you talk about the Lennon Building and Carl Hackman, the other businesses that are in the building, whether they're residential?
I don't know much about the makeup of the building at this point. I haven't really started looking into it.
Would that be part of the consideration?
I think so, but to get a special use permit, the owner of the building has to sign on to it. Mm-hmm. So there's some implied consent there that, you know, as a landlord, they're willing to accept the impact to their adjacent.
Are there residential units in the Lennon Building?
I believe so.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Gillian Connors. Are they legal residential units?
Yeah, that's a question.
Yeah.
Or are they by code, or do we just...
I don't know. I'd have to talk to our zoning administrator about it if they've ever looked into it.
And I'm sorry, just sort of follow up on that. This is John again. The special use permit as it stands is for the entire building. You're saying that you would amend it or include that it would only be for a certain portion of mm-hmm. that. Does when you look at the permit, does it matter what other kinds of businesses are in the building when you evaluate it? I mean, we're talking residential, but you know, in terms of you know, just that there's other businesses that may or may not be impacted by having a special use permit.
The standard of review weights pretty heavily adjacent properties, the impacts to adjacent properties, so across the street in all directions, and anyone you know further out there. It kind of assumes that the people in the building, you know, that can be handled privately. However, these are people, you know, the adjacent property owners are people who have no really civil recourse beyond the special use permit in dealing with impacts.
My name is Rose. I work at the Motor Saloon, and I just wanted to tell you that we're applying for the permit, not the entire building. And you know, the neighbors that we do have we haven't found anyone that has a problem with the permit. So if we did have a neighbor come forward and said, oh, we're against the permit or something, but we've had none of that, so.
So I'm Pete Sim, and that was part of my question. Is there a process to sort of poll the neighbors? I know often if you guys do a zoning change or change of use or something, you'll see little notices up about, you know, that something's contemplated. Is there a process to let people adjacent to the building know that they have an opportunity to give you input one way or the other?
Absolutely. Anyone with a special use permit, with a rezoning, and actually we do this with site plans also, any site plan that's any major site plans, we notify everyone within 500 feet of the property. So people, you know, over in, you know, probably the new Sunrise development will be getting notices about this development.
I live within 500 feet of John Fink. Mm-hmm. And when his garage was being considered, I was never informed.
Right.
And three times this happened.
And that was a VAR. That was a VAR notification at the time they were doing adjacent properties only. Special use permits and rezonings are required by our city code to do 500 feet. I think we've recently started to go 500 feet on the VAR applications.
Okay.
We've always done it with site plans. They may have been doing, at one point they were doing 300, but we've done 500 for all of them. Subdivisions, when somebody's moving a lot line, we don't notify people then because there's not much you can do really. But
I'm Emily Lake. I just want to clarify. You were talking about nobody in the building. Right. There may be different in terms of people that live on the street but that are not in the building.
People on the street also. We have petitions inside the saloon. People come in and write their names down. We have not had anyone come to us face to face and say, this is our issue. You know, we've been kept up at night. Nothing. Not even the police. There have been the most complaints around that, that they have never been about the murder salute. So,
it's not true.
Yes.
It might have been about, you said that a certain, for the SUV, it would be a certain portion of the building would be probably designated for that. Could that portion move to different parts of the building, or are you saying, like, you know, right now it's the front right corner of the building? Could they decide later, the landlord of that building, saying, no, it's going to be the back left?
I think the suggestion from the city will be a condition that limits it to the space that is currently occupied right now. Whether we mention it geographically, however we do it, we're going to write that condition in that way.
Will you just, Robin Haynes, will you just tell us exactly what they have asked for in their SUP?
It's a special use permit for a music hall at that location.
Will you tell us how that is defined?
A music hall in our code is defined as it's any establishment where music is being performed and there is any sort of monetary compensation for viewing the music. And I think it actually covers anyone who's using amplified music at all. We've actually written it that strictly, but if you read the code, it'll mention specifically if you're charging a cover charge, a drink minimum, anything like that, but there's any sort of compensation. But it also covers amplified music really just being performed out in the open or in a building.
So I don't know if you can draw the distinction, but let's say if you went to a place where they, you know, serve food and drinks and they have music playing on a stereo system.
Mm-hmm. That's a restaurant.
If they turn it up too loud, does it all of a sudden become amplified music? I mean, where do you draw the line?
I think it's live performance of music.
So if you have a DJ who's there, who's putting records on, that's considered performance.
Yes.
No. Special use permit. We cannot even have a DJ.
Right. Special use permit is a live performance.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if you had someone who had a CD player in your kitchen or wherever it was and changed CDs, that's fine.
When we crafted the definition, there was the way the definition was written was that we wanted restaurants that had, you know, the piano player at the Aberdeen Barn. That is, you know, that's not a music hall. People that occasionally had somebody performing an acoustic guitar on a stool just for entertaining people. That was fine. It was when it goes to an amplified state that begins to, the noise impact becomes something that we want to take a look at.
And if you pay a cover charge?
That also triggers it.
Okay.
My name is Bartley. I'm just curious, in terms of the whole decibel limit, is there one already? Have they measured it at all during these performances?
I don't know. I haven't been involved with the enforcement of anything out there. I'm just handling the special use permit. There is a noise ordinance in the city. There is a limit. I believe it's 75, and then drops down to 65 at one point. But I don't handle the noise. The noise ordinance is enforced by the police,
right,
not our department. And so they would have, if they were called, they would have the police reports for that. Yeah.
And we've tested it. It does not go above that. Above the limits.
Sorry, does the music hall special use permit contain any restrictions on hours of operation or anything like that?
We can limit them, and I believe that there's something in the request about some sort of hours thing, but you know, they can certainly ask for a condition to be placed on them voluntarily. That is an option. I haven't gotten through the point to where I can tell you what the conditions.
Well, I didn't know if it was automatically part of it. Like can't play amplified music.
No, the laws. I mean, the rules that normally are impacted. You know, the ABC rules at the state level often dictate a lot of that stuff, especially downtown. But we can go stricter with a special use permit in some situations. Yes.
I've got a similar question. What's the situation with three bars down the street that all have to close by midnight? Why is that the case? Like they all say they have to be closed by midnight. Some,
I have no
some
idea.
ABC
it would be.
Yeah.
Be
around
it.
Yeah.
Typically, yeah, it's typically 2 a.m. in the state of Virginia, but there might be something that they have worked out. I mean, each entity has their own liquor license, and the ABC deals with them, and if they've worked out something different with the ABC, they don't notify us.
Right.
Bill Langford. Yeah, I think you touched on this, but I'm not really clear. Mm-hmm. If it were approved with certain conditions applied, what is the enforcement mechanism that those conditions are complied with?
If we are able to substantiate that they have violated those conditions.
Who's we? And
our office, Neighborhood Development Services, the zoning inspector, the zoning administrator.
The police, when the police are called, is that the only mechanism that...
The police deal with noise. They enforce the noise ordinance in the city.
Or any other problem?
No, not necessarily. The noise ordinance, though, for every ordinance, for every chapter that you look at in the ordinance...
As was reported, if there were a fight, as was reported, the police would...
The police would definitely answer that. Any criminal situation, the police handle. If somebody is violating the zoning of a property, then Neighborhood Development Services, our inspectors are in charge, and the zoning administrator is in charge of enforcing the zoning. So often what we will do if we find out someone's violating something is we will, typically the first step is to send a warning letter to say, comply with this. If we accumulate enough evidence that they are continually violating this, in these situations, we take it to council and we can have the special use permit revoked.
And you have staff that goes out and investigates in the middle of the night?
Yes. He lives in Belmont.
And just to be clear, violation of something that doesn't fall under the special use permit doesn't necessarily negate the special use permit, right? Like if there's if there's a health code violation, for example.
Correct.
It's
correct.
Not going to have anything to
do. That deals with the health department.
Right. And if there's some kind of altercation or whatever, that also doesn't affect the special use permit.
It doesn't, but except in the case of a music hall, because that specific section in our code that says calls for service from the police, you know, if you accumulate enough calls for service,
for whatever
we can revoke your music hall thing. Yes.
Okay.
Excuse me. Does the applicant's past history in dealing with zoning or neighborhood planning come into consideration?
Absolutely not.
It does not.
Absolutely not.
On this issue only?
It is. Every application stands on its own by itself.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Greg Gilbert, is that 75 decibels at the sidewalk? Or?
I believe it's at the property line. Okay. Yes.
This is sort of a technical question. What is the frequency response of the decibel meter?
I don't know. I don't know. The police handle the decibel meter, so I'm not sure.
I mean, this is an issue that has been raised by neighbors that it's not the, how can I say it? How do they say it? It's not the sound; it's the vibration of the bass.
I've heard that criticism before, and we had that with Del Rio and the Belmont neighborhood mentioning that. We actually were fortunate enough that.
Is that measured?
I don't think the way our noise ordinance is currently worded that it takes into account the it's dB instead of dBA or whatever it is.
When I worked for OSHA, we just used a meter that was all frequencies. I don't know if they were specified. It's a good question. It's a good issue.
I mean, it's hard to measure.
It's a problem in the past. I don't know when they revised the ordinance last, if they dealt with that issue or not. I haven't dealt with the noise.
Does the pavilion have a special use permit?
No.
Why not?
Because they're in a different zone that allows for musical venues.
So they can have amplification and vibration.
They have noise meters. They actually have permanent noise monitors around that facility that record it and let them know when they're going over.
Does the music hall definition have anything to do with alcohol also?
No. Not that I'm aware of. I have to pull it back up. I don't have it with me. So it's in the definition section of the zoning ordinance. 34-1200 would be our definition for that.
So similar to that question. So is everything they're doing right now totally within the law except for the music hall part down there?
What they are doing right now is within the law. They the story behind that is they, at one point their CO was suspended.
What is this? Yeah.
Certificate of occupancy, okay. Which enables you to occupy a building. Every building should have that was suspended because there was a condition on there about live music that was placed on the CO. That was suspended. They've subsequently said that we will operate as a restaurant until the special use permit is dealt with, and we permitted them once they gave us, you know, that written letter to reopen it as a restaurant and stay within the bounds of the restaurant use.
So was the issue was the issue live music or amplified music? I see those two terms interchangeable. I mean, the stories about all this. So again, if you have a restaurant and the guy's playing acoustical guitar during while people eat, that's okay. It's when it's amplified music that you become a music hall, right?
Right.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, but also
live music, you said.
Live music, yes.
It could be a DJ. We went there to there's a soul music DJ playing. We had a great time. We paid to get in. I think it was like $5 to cover or something like that. And that would also be something that a music hall would do, not a restaurant. And that makes sense.
Yeah, that's what triggers it.
Can you explain why if the zoning didn't allow a music hall that you made a specific note of that on the certificate of occupancy?
Anytime we have, I think, any restaurant, this is the first time we've done it, and I think it's with any restaurant that where we know that, you know, we want to alert the people, the proprietors of the regulations ahead of time. And so that was the reason why, you know, I elected to put that on there. And if, you know, if any future restaurants do it, we're going to do the same thing.
The music hall designation, that's always a special use. Or is it anywhere?
Music hall is a special use in the. Let me explain what the zoning is in this neighborhood. Everything on this side of the road is zoned R1S, single family residential. As you get across Market Street, you get into areas that are zoned MI, manufacturing industrial. Music halls are by special use permit in that zone. The manufacturing industrial zone goes all the way up the other block to Carlton Road. Beyond Beer Runs in it, Mount Groban's on. But all that block is all in. And then from there, the zoning classification switches to what we call downtown extended. So the Coal Tower property and all of that area is in downtown extended. Once you get over to the pavilion, there's the downtown corridor, which is a different zone. Music halls are allowed by right in the downtown area. People don't need a special use permit. The Southern got one, and then now they don't need it anymore. So, yes.
What about other issues for our residential neighborhood as this business, if it grows, like parking?
The parking is a site plan issue for any. You know, any type of use out there, there is a certain parking requirement that needs to be met on the site. We verified that prior to issuing the CO for this property. The special use permit, if the conditions on there about the size of it, if it grows and the parking requirement increases, that would necessitate coming back and amending the special use permit. And by the way, if you want to amend a special use permit, you go through the entire process again. It's no different than the original granting. There's a public hearing. There's a notice. It goes in front of the planning
commission. What is the zoning on Market Street on the other side? The auto stations and the lunchbox and the large commercial buildings?
The lunchbox is manufacturing and industrial. On that side of the street, it goes up further. It kind of flips over to the other side of the road and it goes up further. A Pimento, where Starlight Express was, I know that building's zoned manufacturing industrial. Eventually it becomes downtown extended, or downtown north. I don't know where the lines are.
In the event, Laura, that one of these, that this SUP is approved, how does that impact the future in terms of, say, Motos is approved? Does the Planning Commission take that into account when or if another business like the lunchbox applies?
No. Each property is unique. Mm-hmm. and the situation that they have, especially with this type of application, their solutions to how they would manage something are going to be completely different than what's going on across the street. It's going to be a completely different situation. It does not set a precedent in terms of, okay, we've granted it across the street, we've got to grant it here. If they can't manage the impacts the way they were managed across the street, they can turn it down.
Now, what was the cost of the application of
application fees for a special use permit? $1,500.
How much?
$1,500.
$1,500.
Yeah.
And what does that cover?
It covers all the staff time, all the planning commission time, all the city council time involved in reviewing the application, all those public meetings. We have people who have to take minutes for that. We have staff that put it on television. So there's a lot of costs involved in having these applications heard.
Right. And that's not guaranteed that we will even receive the permit.
No, that covers the cost of the consideration of the application. You pay your, with a rezoning and a special use permit, you pay the money, the application fee, and you get a result, whether it's approval or denial. It's non-refundable.
I think our intention is not to become a music hall. We're only going as a music hall because that's what it's written about and how it's written. We don't intend on having bands there every night. We are doing it to bring in business. People want to see live music. If anyone has any questions, please come see me after the meeting. There's a lot of miscommunication about this. We're not the bad guys. It's a startup business. Waited 4 years to get this loan approved from the bank. Did it on a fraction of that cost. I mean, I think we've really been opening ourselves up to the community, and we've heard a lot of hurtful things from people that don't even know us. The $1,500 permit, that was a lot of money. There have been so many permit costs, so many costs just getting this business up. Okay. It would be nice to see support, but you don't have to. Just please, no negativity.
All right, President. Yeah,
Brian, can you have multiple SUPs on the same property?
Yes. Yes, you can. And there may be a special use permit already on the Linden building. I'd have to look to see if there is one. All right. But you can do that.
And are the special use permits are, we have this one music hall. There's sort of classes or definitions for all the different kinds, or is it just a broad... SUP for really whatever you want to call
no,
it.
No, if you're applying for a special use permit, you are applying for a special use permit for a particular thing. It's Waterhouse, the new building downtown that just opened up that holds World Strides. They just recently went through a special use permit for additional height. It didn't cover anything else. All it gave them was the ability to go up an additional floor on the top of that building. So you can't just, you don't just apply for a special use permit, granted, and it gives you everything that's shown in the code as being by special use permit.
Yeah.
It's a very specific application. Other questions?
So this is more of an informational rather than a opinion sharing thing. Just to be clear, the only times we can say something to the city is at this September 11th meeting or by contacting a city councilman, is that correct?
The way is to contact the city. That's a good question. Obviously, we have email. The city councilor's email is online. My email, all of our staff emails are online, so you can email me. You can email Missy Creasy, who is the kind of serves as the secretary of the planning commission. She's the planning manager. She's my supervisor. So if you need to get a message to the planning commission, we can certainly forward one on very easily. So email works, written letters, we receive written letters. A lot of people email us with a PDF of a written letter. You can bring those in any time. You can send them in now. You can send them in, the day of the meeting. We'd like to get them a week in advance so we can put them in the packet, but we can send them, we can forward them on. I handed a letter to the planning commission as they were going into the meeting yesterday. I don't know how much of their contact info in terms of phone is online, but all the counselors are available by email, and it's, from now up until they take that vote, once the planning commission has made their vote, it's kind of not really contacting them is sort of pointless at that point, but yeah, there's a wide array of means to contact them beyond just appearing at the public hearing and speaking to them. But if you want your comments, your verbal comments on the record, that's a good way to do it. A lot of times what I advise people to do is if you have a lot to write out, 3 minutes goes by really quick when you're up there speaking. So if you write out your comments, send them in advance, and then maybe you have a Cliff Notes version that you want to, if you do want to speak, to do it in that fashion. I've seen a lot of people come up with like 3 pages of stuff and they get through the first moment. And then they're having to get gaveled down because of time considerations.
Bill Langford again. Would you clarify a little bit more the notification within 500 feet, and do the people that are notified have an opportunity through that to respond?
Well, the idea behind the notification, we do 3 things whenever we get a public hearing item. We put signs near the property notifying that an application has been filed at our office and has our phone number on it. We send a letter by mail to everyone within 500 feet, every mailing address within 500 feet of the property. And we also publish an ad in the Daily Progress in the classifieds. Look for it. They've been trying to get that requirement out of the state code. The signs are voluntary. We do that as above and beyond. In fact, we may have new ones out there that are much bigger. We just went through a process of redesigning our signs. All of that is designed for notification, to let people know that it's happening, because back in the day, people would just schedule a public hearing and not tell anyone, and hold a meeting in the basement somewhere. And this was one of those ways that communities used to disenfranchise people. So these are laws. These are things that we have to comply with to do that. The mechanism would be the same as anyone else in this room in terms of getting in contact. People can email me. If they call the front desk, you're going to get forwarded to me because I'm a planner for the application. I can answer questions. I can take comments.
So that letter you send doesn't ask for input.
It has our contact information if you want further information or to make a comment.
Also,
that's what it's there for.
Right. And what is the timing? Sorry, John Crazy. What is the timing of the sign and the letters? How much in advance of?
We have to publish the ad 2 and 1 week ahead of time. We've got to publish it twice. So 2 and 1 week ahead of time, ahead of the actual public hearing. The letters go out as soon as we can, really. Once we've verified that we've actually got, we have a pre-application meeting. We had our last Planning Commission meeting last night. We're working on the new agenda tomorrow. So as soon as we've got a final list of everything, then we draft up a letter and send it. So you'll see it definitely more than a week in advance, probably 2 weeks in advance. The signs, we try to get those up 2 weeks in advance.
Okay. Emily Lane, I know that the your contact information has been on the listserv before, but if you or someone in the neighborhood could send it around again with yours and the Planning Commission's, the pertinent people to send a letter to, that'd be helpful.
Okay. Sir?
It sounds like the Planning Commission is sort of a series of people making points, their own points, but is there any way that you all could facilitate a discussion between both parties in which both parties could say what they wanted and sit down with you all at the same time while you're writing up or considering the SUP?
That's not a typical process, in part because it's hard to get a lot of, we can get people where we've had contentious debates. There have been times when at the initiative of the people involved with that, we've come in and facilitated it. We're kind of as a staff, we're kind of in a position where, we've got to look at it as a kind of a different set of eyes, the professional planner looking at this and evaluating it based on the code. But we have had, in several cases where we've had, there was a lot of concern about an application and the applicant was willing to meet. We have done those. We have scheduled those. It does come at the initiative of the applicant. And the planning, the public hearing is also kind of that forum for the applicant to present their project and argue for it, and for the public to argue for, against, or just bring up concerns that they have, and have it all put in front of the Planning Commission and allow them to kind of pull it all together and decide which way to lean.
So in that vein, it seems that a lot of what people are worried about is the noise. Mm-hmm. And none of us really know what that's like. So there wouldn't be any reason that the applicant couldn't, for example, one night play recorded amplified music at whatever volume we would expect the band to be in and invite people to come down or stand outside the building.
Nothing wrong with that. Just give us a heads up that you're doing it. So that we don't get the police. The police
don't
call.
Don't realize it.
That we notify and we let the police know that it's happening, yeah, just right. In case there's a call about it.
This isn't really a question. My name's Phil Emery, but in a case like that, it wouldn't exactly replicate a regular night where there was actual live customers. I mean, it would replicate how good the soundproofing was in the building, but it wouldn't necessarily.
Right, it wouldn't necessarily be the same, but it would be better than what we have.
Right. But I mean, in the case of Del Rio, much of the complaint wasn't about the noise from the building, it was the noise from the customers. You know, walking back to their car, slamming, you know, doors opening and closing. And that's the part of a sound test that you would not be able to efficiently or effectively get.
To add to that, I had a long conversation with a business owner on me who said that when customers were leaving, and these were bikers, they had great joy in revving their engines to an incredible degree, and this causes a great deal of noise. Now, this is not the fault of the owner of the business, but it is a byproduct of it being there, and you know that is also a consideration. And there are at that corner there are some residences that are impacted by this.
Right.
Is that taken into account?
Well, yes, exactly. Is it taken into account?
I mean, people leaving an establishment, that definitely gets taken into account. There is an impact there. When it comes to, you know, certain people revving their engines, that's a hard thing to control for.
Right.
Well, of course it is, but it is a byproduct.
So if, I mean, another way to put it would be, if there's a noise violation that's more or less at an establishment, and I don't know if they could define it, you know, so someone calls and says, I just got woken up by this noise, it came from this place. Is that the same kind of infraction that would be considered when you looked at the SUP as far as their compliance with noise regulations? Or is it unrelated because someone is out in front of a business and screaming their head off, they're not necessarily the responsibility of the business owner and therefore it doesn't count? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I'm not sure how exactly that, we haven't really tested it along those grounds, so that would be something that I'd have to discuss further with the staff. You
have a question. I'm Rachel. Actually, I was wondering, I know you said they were on the Moon Code or whatever, but what were the, there's like some things about the last part of the list of impacts that I didn't really get. I thought I was kind of referring to like,
Let me see here.
She's got a written copy.
Okay. I think B is the one that primarily applies in this situation. A lot of the last ones are all related to the construction of buildings.
Right.
By and large, and a fair amount of this criteria only apply to when you're building a new building.
What time is the meeting on September 11th?
September 11th, the Planning Commission meeting. They meet for a pre-meeting in our conference room. They assemble at around. They start assembling at 4:30. They don't actually start doing anything till 5. They're just really. It's kind of a. We're there for them to chat with and talk about the items that they want to. From 5 to 5:30, they will ask questions for clarity of us in some cases. So there's nothing, they're not debating, they're not, it's only questions for clarity. If they ever stray into starting to talk about the application, they get stopped very quickly by Missy. And then at 5:30, they convene in the City Council chambers. Public hearings do not start until 6 o'clock sharp. And sometimes they will start later than that if the City Council is slow getting out of their closed session. They usually hold a closed session that night, and sometimes they're a little slow.
Will you tell everybody where it is?
Yeah, it's City Hall in it's 610 East Market Street, or I forget the East Main Street address, but it's 600 block. It's a big brick building down there with three presidents on it.
Okay.
the mall entrance is the best one to use.
Is it the same chambers that they held the city council meeting?
Yes, absolutely. The pre-meeting is in our conference room, which is just down the hall.
And you said that is open or it's not open?
Absolutely, it is open to the public. Anytime you get three commissioners in the room, it's open to the public.
And it's upstairs, right, on the second or third floor?
The city council chambers, if you enter off the mall, it's the second floor. If you enter off of East Market Street, you're on the second floor of City Hall, so it's all right there. But sometimes that door, I think that door locks at 5.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
When will they make the decision that night?
Planning Commission, they can delay if they want to. They usually have a certain amount of time. I think they can usually only delay for 1 month if they want to. But they typically, if they feel they have all the information that they need at that meeting, they will make a recommendation at the meeting. They like to not have to deal with things twice. But sometimes they do. The item I had last time, we got deferred. So, and then the city council's decision will come 3 weeks later. One thing to point out about city council, if the planning commission recommends approval for an item, and if they recommend it unanimously, that item will go on a consent agenda. And what a consent agenda is in city council is it's a long list of things that they approve right at the beginning of the meeting, and it goes by in a flash. What it means is all 5 counselors, none of them have an opposition to it. They're fine with it going. Most of our items where there's a recommendation of approval and it's unanimous, that's where they go through. There won't be any kind of discussion or anything in front of city council. You'll have to look at that list and see if it's on there. And if they don't pull it off, it'll go through when they approve the consent agenda. If it's a split vote, a lot of times, then city council might not be too comfortable with putting it on the consent agenda. And they might have it as a regular item. If it's a recommendation of a denial, it always goes on the regular agenda, and they will actually discuss it in the open chambers. You can't put a recommendation of denial on the consent agenda. I've never seen them do it.
I'm also kind of wondering, can you just think about a lot of few police calls, a certain number? I mean, potentially, can people just keep calling the police? Or, I mean, do the police have to come out and see that they're...
There was a concern. I think that concern was raised.
Yeah.
That concern was raised during the crafting of that ordinance, and I think there was a check put in to make sure of that. But I'd have to look at it more. I don't know a whole lot about the ordinance in terms of the actual technicalities of it.
Right.
So that'll be something that we'll probably have to explain during the process. Right.
Complaints.
Yeah. And I don't know what the terminology is, but there's certain levels of a police response to something.
Okay.
There's certain levels of that. So I don't know what the terminology they used in the code, but I'll look at it.
I mean, it would seem to be unfair if someone wanted to subvert it and just call the police
right
every night of the week.
I think it may be something about something, a call for service that results in an incident report or something
right
like that, in which, you know, so there's actually got to be something going on.
Right.
All right. There's nothing else. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.